something in the water. There's something in the water. What makes her crazy? I don't know. Never seen anything like her before. There must be something in the water.
Hello, welcome to the Quarter to Three Movie Podcast for the Dune 2 synopsis. I am Tom Chick, and to deliver the synopsis and to start us off maybe with a Dune Part 2 tagline, Kelly Wand.
Oh, so that's why the Fremen call dirt bikes dune buggies. Oh.
Okay, Kelly Wand, I understand they get better as they go. What is the next tagline for Dune Part 2?
Finally, a Denis Villeneuve movie that's oranger than Blade Runner.
I like it. I like where this is going, Kelly Wand. Is there a third Dune Part 2 tagline?
They grow like sandworms, Tom. And get...
Are sandworms prolific? I'm not real clear on certain elements of sandworm ecology.
I didn't know prolific was the right word for that.
But
I guess it makes sense, yeah.
I guess promiscuous.
Promiscuous.
Well, Kelly Wand, do we have a third tagline?
Finally, James Brolin with a beard.
I'm angry that that's a spoiler, Kelly Wand. I had no idea, by the way, he was alive. I flipped the fuck out. I am so glad that was not spoiled for me. Okay, is there another tagline?
No.
Okay, good, because Kelly Wand, we've got some business to get down to.
Yeah.
No, I need to hear a synopsis, but first let me tell you a couple things. Dune Part 2 is rated R for scenes.
No, it's not.
I was trying to troll you. Did you know? I guess you knew that.
I could tell very much that you're wrong.
Oh, it's one of my big... I feel like he shot an R-rated movie.
I know.
And
it's
it
like
fucking got cut down to a PG-13.
Yeah,
I don't remember feeling that way about Dune Part 1.
No.
I mean, I remember that certain parts... Anyway, that made me angry at certain parts of Dune 2. But it's PG-13 for sequences of strong violence, some suggestive material. And Kelly Wand, please explain this one to me. And brief, strong language.
I don't remember that. I guess when he said Dune at the end, he said it in a strong voice. So that counts.
But I'm wondering, they didn't slip an F-bomb in there, right? Like, what's...
That word doesn't exist anymore. It's the future, Tom.
Like, did someone say shit or something at some point? I have no idea why there's a brief, strong language disclaimer, but
Maybe maybe there was an F-bomb. I don't remember. I was pretty big, bro.
I mean, I would think it would stand... Like, when they said fuck on Star Trek for the first time, that was a big deal.
Did they?
When they said it in Star Wars on that stupid Andor show, that was a big deal. Didn't they say fuck the... Didn't that... who was that
English
actress?
I didn't see Andor.
Not
I'm
Emma Thompson. Who's the woman... yeah, there's a fuck the Empire rallying cry at the finale of Andor. Which
I'm not sure how I feel about that, and I'm
dumb.
All
it's
for
dumb.
Profanity, but I don't.
It's dumb. It's stupid. It
feels out of
it's
character.
It's as dumb as you think. Yep.
It's like Yoda saying it.
It's like Yoda with a lightsaber, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, but so I rate.
Yes, Kelly Wand. Is there anything that the MPA missed besides sequences of strong violence, suggestive material, and brief strong language? Is there anything else parents should be warned about in this movie?
Well, I missed the F-bomb, so maybe the MPAA, FTC is smart, and I'm the buffoon. Maybe they're the Kwisatz, and I'm the Haderach. But I rate Dune Part. They went Part 2? Dune Part 2, the movie?
Yeah.
Rated DG-13 for some Chris Knives and Lay's guns, pervasive shout-out mapes, and ghostly Christopher Walken.
I like your pervasive shout-out mapes.
A big shout out to Shadow Vapes. She's
Kelly
one of my
Wand.
Favorites. And she just nothing, I don't know. Dune's full of like thankless roles is what's fun to me. And so it's just like they get all these amazing actors. Like Jason Momoa, one of our most amazing actors, for example. Your
you
Linda
say,
Hunt. Yeah?
You say thankless, but Like some, you know, did you know that Tim Blake Nelson actually filmed sequences for Doom Part 2? Like, you want to talk about thankless, some actors actually got cut from it.
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, I don't want to spoil too much of the opposite.
Oh, yeah, yeah, well, hold that thought real quick. So, Dune Part 2, on every critical metric, not my metric personally, by the way, we'll get into that, was better than Dune Part 1. So, on CinemaScore, audience who go to Dune Part 1, they come out and they give it an A-. People who go to Dune Part 2... they come out and they give the cinema score a regular A, no minus for part two.
Wait, the critics give it a minus and normals give it a normal A?
Nope, so a cinema score is always an audience poll. So the cinema score for Dune part one was A minus. The cinema score for Dune part two was a regular A.
So, audiences, so they lost the minus from 1 to 2. Got it. So.
Right, right. Audiences, and my point, this is where I'm going, critics agreed that Dune Part 2 was better than Part 1, which is the inverse of, I think, my own opinion, which we'll talk about shortly.
Oh, I can't wait.
On Rotten Tomatoes, the Rotten Tomatoes is the conglomerate, the aggregate of all reviews for Dune. 83% positive.
83? That's kind of low.
For Dune 2, 93% of all reviews are positive.
And maybe that's due to it them seeing it on a small screen, but Denis Villeneuve would argue.
Could be.
Then the spectacle was diminished.
Could be, but I doubt it because these Rotten Tomatoes ratings tend to be locked in around the release of the movie. So this would have been its theatrical release.
I don't know if I trust any of the ratings in any movie.
Well, a Metacritic,
like Mother,
which is
was a 40 or something.
Oh, sure, yeah. Darren Aronofsky does confound critics and viewers alike. Yes.
And if a movie means well, critics will like it. So that doesn't mean shit, does it?
So on Metacritic, which is the average rating of different reviews, Dune 1, Part 1, came in at 74. Dune Part 2 on Metacritic came in at 79. So, Kelly Wand, Dune Part 2 improved on all of these metrics based on what the audience thought and what critics thought.
My theory on that is people expect something in a Part 2, and then in a Part 1 they go, well, it's as a setup, I guess it's this, and then they can't judge it too high because they don't know what the payoff is. But if the two is a good resolution, then they'll like it more than the setup, because it's like, oh, now we got all what we came for the first time, like
could
the climax
be. Sure, could
fascinating
be.
Wand, no one cares. All right,
well, I tend to think of it more as this is just how franchises work. And as a matter of fact, I will get into this in a minute. I'm just going to drop this and then we'll get to the synopsis. But my whole issue with Dune 2 is I wanted from Denis Villeneuve a story, and instead I didn't realize he was kickstarting a franchise. And that gets at my whole issue with Dune 2, but I think that's also why people responded more strongly to Dune 2, is just being set up as a franchise. They have fond memories of the first movie. So I think that's just how a lot of movie sequels work a lot of times, is the people who come back to the sequel, they're just already invested.
Well, they played themselves, because the books get way less, they get more intricate and political and less cinematic and brooding as they go. So, and the second one's almost the most like that.
Oh, I can't imagine.
Dune books you read.
What's going to happen? None after the first
later.
One. Yeah, yeah. So, Kelly Wand, let's get down to the brass tacks here. A lot happened in this movie. I need you to remind me before we talk about it. Mm-hmm. I need you to remind me what happened with a brief synopsis of Dune 2. Dune Part 2. Do you think you could do such a thing for me? And if you could, Kelly Wand, what would it be called?
Dutwopsis?
How do you spell that belch? I'm not sure.
D-O-O... -TWAPSIS.
Got it. All right, so the Dune Twopsis.
I skipped the colon.
That's fine. That's, you know.
Just like my sunflower seeds do.
Kelly Wand, take it away. Remind us of the events of Dune 2 with your Dune Twopsis.
Dune Twopsis. Oh, and by the way, the guy who gave me the certificate at Dingus's memorial for seeing movies, I spent it on seeing Dune 2. So you've contributed to this.
Very nice.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I'm sorry I didn't get his name, but we were all like kind of, it was like a very chaotic moment. And then later on, I couldn't find him. So if you write something in the comments. Yeah, do you remember who I'm talking about? That guy?
I remember meeting a lot of fantastic people at Christian's Memorial. Many of them, I did not get their names, and I feel bad about that.
Yeah, there's a lot going on.
I remember many people sidling up to us and just saying very, very kind things.
And he was one of those, and he gave me a certificate. And it was it looked like a Wonka ticket. It was all golden and very embroidered.
Oh,
that's
so
sweet.
I
felt bad I didn't get his name. Anyway, this is your opsis, so enjoy it. Dune Twopsis. A few scenes I remember from watching Dune Super Bait. Paul and Sanjaya and their Arabic Fremens are collecting rocks of the desert where they notice some Harkonnens walking around in black fireman suits from Fahrenheit 451. Sanjaya is all, psst, caw, 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 Fremen rule, shh. The Fremen all giggle and scatter, but they accidentally forget to bring Sanjaya's ex-boyfriend's corpse that's wrapped up in a mail bag. Paul also forgets to hide, so he looks around and grabs a nearby rock to throw as 12 heavily armed enemies approach, wheezing through their gas masks. Anton Chigurh in a turban rises into view beside me and stage whispers, "It is said that in the opening scene, the Chosen One will forget to hide and grab a nearby rock." He sinks back out of you.
Kelly, what if you're going to keep doing this? I don't know that I can make it through the whole synopsis.
Tom, it's Stilgar.
It is, isn't it?
He's a 7 in the board game. That's his number. Remember? Or whatever those are called. "Look, sir, a guy wrapped in a mailbag. Hey, there's words written on it. Use me as bait to lure Harkonnens into ambush. What do you think, sir?" Jessica stabs him. The other Harkonnens run around in circles, sobbing and shooting each other while the Fremen pick them off PG-13-ly. "Well, thanks, Mom. That was weird, though. You were right here beside me. How'd you get up there on the ridge so instantaneously?" "I used the voice. Always, always." Sanjaya walks up. "Hey, your mom saved you. Not bad, Usul. But you may want to try other weapons than rocks next time, like these swords we always use, or these guns we never use." Chalamet's all, "I like holding things in my hand when I look at you, Channy." Chigurh appears upside down from the top of the screen and stage whispers, "It is said that he will be hot for Sanjaya, our only hot girl."
Besides, hey, I thought her little buddy was pretty cute. Come on.
We'll get to her.
Okay.
You would, Sarah Palin enthusiast. But it's just... Beside me, Graham Chapman yawns. Everybody gets bored and returns to Fremen Zion. At first, the lookouts are wary of Paul and Jessica, considering them spies, but Chigurh reminds them that Scripture predicted they'd be suspicious, so they shrug at each other and let them in. In keeping with Fremen ritual, they unwrap the mailbag guy and put fried eggs on his eyes. Then they stick straws at him and start sucking out his fluids. Jessica's all, "Ugh, and I'm a Harkonnen." But Paul and Sanjaya stare sensuously deep into each other's eyes as they suck furiously from the straws poking from her former boyfriend's buttocks. Meanwhile, in a Harkonnen control room with poor lighting and evil radar screens. "Tomorrow War! Beast Raban, please, we just lost our 9th patrol to yet another body wrapped in a mailbag. I think maybe the best thing for you, young man, is to go get some sleep." Dave Bautista smashes his head to a pulp against a router. PG-13! "Double the mailbag patrols and nuke every mountainside!" Beside me, Frank Herbert's ghost is all, I really like how they captured Appendix E, and especially what they did with Leah Kynes. Meanwhile, in a Fremen Afghani cave.
And that is why it was called the Jesus Incident. I think. Now it is time for our newest fighter, Paul Atreides, to pick his desert spirit animal name. Although, let's just keep calling the mom Jessica, less hassle. Paul Atreides, name thyself.
Sanjaya's fugly friends all. How about fuckhead? The other one that Tom likes is all Wonka? Paul's all,
those desert mice, I accidentally squished one in my shoe this morning. But wait, what was your question? Sanjaya gasps. Ah, the Al Goblin Noebru. The craftiest of beasts. It is said he who names himself thus shall rule over us, and that all things will be great until the second book. No, I don't want to rule over you. I just want to fight beside you and be inside. What's her face here?
The Fremen all murmur and stroke each other's beards, including Tom's girlfriend. Chigurh prods Jessica with his foot.
Speaking of beards, our Reverend Mother is dying. Man, she was wild back in her day. That's her natural eye color. Anyway, we require that you replace her by drinking the potentially fatal water of life. Otherwise, we must give your water back to the desert, which is a popular euphemism among us for kill.
Jessica's all cool. Later in the holy cave of giggling crones.
Ferguson. I am the dying old woman. Also in the scenes. I'm speaking to you telepathically. Remember when Tom and Dingus praised how platonic your and Tom Cruise's relationship was in Mission Impossible, possible? And then you guys made out, in the next movie. Those buffoons.
Yeah, Granny, you're not telepathic. You're just talking in a normal voice. We can all hear you.
Silence! Jessica Atreides, drink this. No, this. The blue one. No, the blue one. No, Justice Kelly's edible peaks. Yes.
Meanwhile, on a romantic rock.
Tell me of your homeworld, Usul. Oh, why are you talking all weird all of a sudden?
It's from your vision or McLaughlin's, Sean Young.
Oh, what? Is this the only scene where you ever call me Usul?
Oh, Usul, tell me again of this thing called rain.
Oh, yeah, water comes out of the sky and leaks through the hole in Kelly's ceiling. It sucks.
And tell me again of these automatic doors.
Oh, they, like, slide open. Sometimes I bash my face into them. They suck.
Oh, Usul, show me how your people kiss.
Better yet, let me show you this thing we invented called third base. I mean, I love you as long as I breathe.
Ow, easy on the biting.
Okay, not that easy.
I lean over to Kim Stanley Robinson sitting beside me and go, wouldn't mind guzzling me some of that water of life. Know what I mean? He says something about carbon or carbonated drinks. I can't really follow it. Meanwhile, back in the movie.
Muad'Dib, today is your final test. If the prophecies are true, you shall use these steel spike Barbara Cramptons to ride a sandworm around while we all watch and cheer from over here. Which hopefully doesn't summon more worms, huh? Oh, also, hope that the worm doesn't roll over on top of you. That's an old saying among the Fedaken. We lose most of our fighters that way.
Chalamet nudges Sanjaya.
Hey, speaking of riding the worm, remember last night?
Oh,
you said it was worm-like?
No, Kelly won. No.
Texture? It is said that he will make dick jokes to my possible granddaughter, Sanjaya.
The believer Fremen all cheer at this, but Sanjaya and Gillian Anderson and all the skeptic Fremen are all... Sanjaya's ugly friend that Tom likes is all, ha-ha, you are the most feminine character in Little Women. Sanjaya's all, yeah?
Which one of them is in Little Women?
Timothy Chalamet, he's the...
He's in Little Women!
Spoiler alert.
All right, I guess I'll see it. All right, go ahead, sorry.
Gerwig wasn't enough to entice you. You needed a Chalamet. Sanjaya is all, Paul, be careful. Promise me you'll only ride a small one. Chalamet is all. He walks off to some random patch of sand doing a lot of somersaults and one-legged hops and the Wednesday dance.
Oh, he did the Wednesday dance and the magical Fremen walk without anyone teaching him its ways.
Hey, look, he's shouting to us, probably saying something really wise. 100 yards away, Paul's all, yeah, there was a stone in my skate. That's why I was walking weird. But I guess you can't hear me. Shrugging, he sets down his thumper and sets its dial to thump. A distant mountain of sand begins gliding closer. Sanjaya's all, no, that's the biggest worm signage ever. She makes her slightly worried face.
Don't worry. It is said that his death will be anticlimactic at the end of Doom Messiah, which... accessibility-wise, will make three-body problem look like K-Pax.
Paul tricks the worm by it not eating him, then sticking hooks in its side and riding it around while sand flies into his mouth and eyes. Beside me, Tony Hawk checks his phone to see what time Kung Fu Panda's playing. Finally, the worm gets tired and remembers it can submerge, so Paul staggers back to the Fremen cheering area and grins at Sanjaya through teeth flecked with dead bugs. She nods gravely, then shrugs baffled at Villeneuve. Meanwhile, on a spaceship, Emperor Wakham IV takes his daughter Florence Pugh's hands in both of his own.
I got a fever, and the prescription is more Sardaukar.
Beside me, one of the aliens from Communion saw, we meant to abduct James Woods.
I want you to marry Fade Rotha. He played Elvis, so try remembering that during the consummation.
Fade Rotha? He's psychotic. Can't I marry the Baron or Beast Rabin instead? Beside Walken, Leah Sidhu peeks into frame. I'm also in this! Lady Fenring, fan favorite. Meanwhile, in a coliseum. Ladies and gentlemen, I mean second movie antagonist Fade Rotha, in honor of your birthday. I guess Gady Prime and Ericus have similar year lengths. Here we present you with the greatest gift of all, the final three surviving Atreides, one of whom is part Japanese. The crowd cheers. In Harkonnen tradition, they shoot a bunch of black paint out of some cannons to splat against the glass dome to celebrate. Oh, yeah, the last three, except for Paul, Atreides, obviously, and his mother, and Guernsey Halleck. He's driving a harvester today. More cheers and black paint explosions. And Thu for Haywat, I guess he's in the deleted scenes. And Momoa, who might be a Gola. More cheers and paint. Lord Fade Rotha, as a tribute to your combat prowess, these three prisoners have all been half-starved and severely beaten, but still should be a cool matchup and really set you up as a daunting foe. A single paintball goes off. While Fade Rotha kills the stuntmen one by one PG-13-ly, I lean over to Tom and go, they're practicing the ancient art of Canley, by the way.
I actually knew that.
Tom's all... Oh, really? The Eternals use CG. Later that morning, James Brolin is driving a harvester across some sand. He sighs like he just found a briefcase full of money by a dead guy under a tree and goes,
wasn't there some line in the first movie about how we harvest at night because of the intense heat?
Villeneuve's all, shh. Suddenly, the Harkonnens on the harvester think they see a body in a mailbag up ahead, so they all get out, then get shot with darts by giggling Fremen while a sandstorm obscures all the violence. Much to my and Tom's irritation. I guess even in his still suit, Brolin is still recognizable as an ally to the Fremen since they all just run past him and don't attack, while Chalamet starts to pretend to, then pulls off his mask and drops Trow.
Guernsey, it's me! Remember these?
Kid, is that you? I haven't seen those in, is it years or weeks?
Chalamet offers the ancient Fremen handshake.
Welcome to the Resistance, Guernsey. I knew you'd never sell out to the Harkonnens.
They made me drive their harvesters and have sex with the Baron. I was all, I disapprove. But yeah, I was thinking of you the whole time, kid. Hey, remember when I used to play this thing?
He raises a baby's crib.
Guernsey, you played a balisette, a stringed instrument, not a bass. Oh, come here, you. They roughly changed faces.
I just got that.
I was worried. Never mind. Hey, so I hear your mom's single now.
Yeah, and with those tattoos, she's gonna be for a while. Sanjaya, meet my friend and combat trainer Guernsey. He's gonna be bunking with us.
Later on a dune on Dune.
Sanjaya, there's something we need to talk about.
Yeah, Guernsey, is there any way he can sleep not in the middle at least one night?
Sanjaya, that blue venom.
Wait, that wasn't you in the middle last night? Oh my god. Anyway,
that blue venom my mom drank that made her fetus talk to her and that no man can drink and survive. When I told her how parts of me feel about you, she told me she wants me to drink some of it.
Chigurh says it's part of the prophecy. I don't think they're banging, but they may as well be.
Paul, no, our love. No, I don't believe. No. Did you see the trailer for that movie where I'm a tennis star who breaks her leg and gets into a situationship? Is that a biopic? Paul, no. Sanjaya, I keep having visions of a PG-13 jihad that I'm gonna cause if I do drink the worm goo. Billions dead. Which makes it sound like I'll survive the drinking part, so sweet. Paul, you said you'd love me as long as you breathe.
Right? But do you really breathe while you're in a coma?
The next day, Paul goes into the holy cave of cackling Fremen crones and drinks the water of life. He trips out so hard he sees Anya Taylor-Joy.
Timothy and Kelly, it's me. I'm not actually in this franchise yet, but I love you. At least I will until my soul gets possessed by the Baron Harkonnen. Spoiler alert. I guess Herbert was really inspired by Amityville. Beside me, Alicia Witt's all, I think she's had some work done.
Near Paul's twitching body in the cave, Jessica pats a distraught Sanjaya a couple of times on the back.
There, there. There.
Oh, hey, if you're gonna cry, maybe do it into the carafe here. Perfect. No, don't blow your nose into it. Actually, it's fine, probably. It's Paul drinks the Sanjaya tear water and farts awake.
Oh, I've seen what happens in the next movie. The jihad's gonna be awesome. But that part's probably going to be between the movies.
Sanjaya runs off crying. Jessica walks up and squeezes Chalamet's nose. I saw that you would say that.
Chigurh stands up. It is said that his mother will tell him that she foresaw his statements.
Brolin walks up.
By the way, I know the whereabouts of the family Atomics. I guess the Harkonnens forgot to ask me about it. Too bad we didn't use him in the first movie during the attack, huh?
Thank you, Guernsey. Loyal Guernsey. I talk like this now that I've drunk in the water of life. And I act like this.
He walks into a crowd of chanting Arabs and kicks over a microphone.
I am now the ruler of you all! I am Paul Madweeb Atreides.
Harkonnen.
Yeah,
me. The Fremen cheer and sway. One guy pours gasoline all over himself and lights a match.
Now I will go and do what I must do to do what must be done. I have the perfect plan, my desert Fedakin, and all it needs to succeed is a random sandstorm happening just as the Emperor lands in the Harkonnen capital / army base with his daughter, who will fortunately already be wearing a bridal veil. Spoiler alert.
The next day, Chalamet and the Fremen attack the Harkonnens while CG dust spews expensively. Finally, in a throne room.
Paul Atreides, son of Leto Atreides from the book Dune by Frank Herbert.
Greetings, Emperor Wakam. I am here to claim my birthright, killing my cousin and marrying Virginia Madsen. Sidney Sweeney. I mean, blind.
Fade Rotha slinks into view. His bald goth posse's all,
oh, shit.
Paul and Fade Rotha fight until Paul tricks Fade Rotha into stabbing him repeatedly. Finally,
behold, Fade Rotha, I stabbed you back once off screen. So, yeah.
Chigurh's all,
it is said that the Chosen One would be stabbed quite a bit, but still win somehow.
Chalamet's all, oh yeah, and also kills Baron Harkonnen. Walken bows, puts his ring on Chalamet's finger and kisses it, and also the ring, until Chalamet yanks it, disgusted. After some initial confusion involving Lea Seydoux, Chalamet embraces Florence Pugh and raises her hand entwined with his. Let our new royal line be consummated often. Sanjaya runs off angry and sobbing. Chalamet's all, it's her deal. Guernsey's all, hooray for Paul and Dune the movie, part two. The Fremen all cheer. The Harkonnens all shake their fists. Jessica walks up to Charlotte Rampling and goes, see? As some credits tell me who animated the sand, Tolkien stands up in front of me and goes, lol. Yeah. So that's the Dunopsis.
Kelly, one, that was one for the ages.
Okay, good. I was a little blocked on it. It took a little longer than normal. Sorry about that.
Dune is a perfectly opsible. I mean, all you did was tell us what we saw, Kelly Wand.
The movie's 3 hours, and the opsis is really kind of short, actually. But I realize it's because he doesn't like dialogue. He says he said that Denis Villeneuve. So, anyway. Yeah,
Kelly Wand, what did you think? So you already know I'm a little. So first of all, I want to say, I fucking love this movie, even though I was disappointed in elements of it. Man, I had an amazing time. It's mostly what I wanted, but I do have some deep reservations, basically about its open-endedness, its lack of resolution. That really, really bothered me in the first movie, and I just hated it being repeated again at the end of the second movie. So that's my main drawback, is I feel like Villeneuve did not wrap things up the way I was expecting they would be. And that bothered me a lot.
Well, do you know how the book ends?
I actually don't. And, like, I haven't read the book since I was a child.
Yeah, me neither. I didn't care for Dune much as a child. I appreciate its finer points now, but I thought Frank Herbert felt like grinding sand in my eyes at the time. But I read the first four, even though I felt that way.
I didn't read any of the others, so I didn't remember.
Yeah, I read four.
Like, and in a way, Kelly Wand, you know me, I'm all about fuck the source material. Yeah. Like, I'm here for what Denis Villeneuve wrote with John Spates and put on screen. I am curious about some of the changes from the books. But for the most part, I couldn't care less about the books, even though it's now obvious that he wants and expects a third movie.
Which will be great, because it's so fucking audience unfriendly.
Well, he'll get a third movie, and he can probably do whatever he wants with it, I'm assuming.
Yeah, he can deviate, I guess.
Yeah. So, but a couple of quick questions. Did Gurney Halleck survive in the book?
If I remember right, he just shows up at the very end. And he's all, hey, you're back. And then the other deviations were Aaliyah, Paul's sister.
Right.
And Taylor Joy. She's like a little girl. She was Alicia Witten. She stabs the Baron and with the gom jabber. So
that's
she kills
some nice
him.
Comeuppance. Yeah, I can see.
But then he winds up possessing her in later on in another book. So in a way, I didn't make that part up. But also the last line of Dune, the novel, is Jessica consoling Chani about Paul marrying for power. And she goes, think on it, Chani. That princess will have the name, yet she'll live as less than a concubine, never to know a moment of tenderness from the man to whom she's bound. While we, Chani, we who carry the name of concubine, history will call us wives. And then that's the last line of the book.
Oh.
So compare that to the ending of the movie.
So I am so deeply ambivalent about the ending of the movie, and I'm not even sure I understood it. And so much of it was just so quick. Like, why would the other houses challenge him if he's poised to, like, nuke the universe's spice supply? Like, that made no sense to me. This sudden, nobody accepts
you. Yeah, that means his plan didn't work, doesn't it?
Right. I mean, nobody accepted him, so now he has to go on this holy war. Like, I just wanted to know more about, wait, what? Like, that was my whole takeaway. And it was just one line, if I'm not mistaken. It's something like, my lord, the other houses refuse to recognize you.
Yeah, I can't remember if that's from the book either. Like, the guild wasn't in the movie, Dune, that much. But my question is, like, if Paul can see the future, why doesn't he know about the cabal in the second book that's trying to assassinate him that does take him by surprise. And, like, other things. Like, why wouldn't he know everything that's going to happen? Or is that... I don't know. I guess that's the problem with anything involving prophecy, is, like...
Right, and
you
and
see
I think,
it, but you can't help it, and it's inevitable, and...
And I can't address Macbeth. What the books were doing, but clearly the conceit of prophecy, and Denis Villeneuve is very, very explicit about establishing this. I would say this is actually a major reveal in the first movie, is that prophecy can be changed. Is that because he saw that, was it Janus, the man that he fought and murdered at the end of, and killed at the end of the first movie?
Yeah, Janus. They put eggs on his eyes.
So he saw that Janus was going to be his teacher. And he saw Janus teaching him things about the desert. Janus was the man that in the prophecy that he saw would shepherd him through the ways of the Fremen. But he ends up murdering Janus, and that's a big reveal in the first movie, is that even though he sees something as the future, he can change it.
I'm curious if that's from the book, too.
Well, I don't know if it's from the book, but it's very explicit. And I think it's the first Dune, part one, it's basically the final point of part one.
Right.
Is that even though he's seen the future, he now realizes that he has changed the future he's seen.
Is that the only time that happens, though? Because nothing in the second movie suggests what you're talking about to me.
Everything in the second movie suggests it because he's constantly remembering Janus. I would say, I mean, that's just my interpretation, but there are a lot of flashbacks to Janus still teaching him things. This prophecy of Janus as his teacher, his kind of Obi-Wan to the ways of the Fremen, like that is something he experienced and that he still has memories of, even though Janus is dead, right?
So Chani was the mule, the mutant element that ruined that timeline?
Well, I don't know. I think this idea of timelines is such a Marvel conceit that we should just drop. Because to me, and what I appreciate about this, is it gets more in line with the traditional biblical concept of prophecy. Where prophecy doesn't mean prediction. It's more about warning. Prophecy, in the biblical sense, is always someone showing up and saying, hey, if you guys keep doing this, God is really going to fuck you over.
Right.
And a key part of prophecy is that always the people who listen have the chance to react and escape that fate or that eventuality. Prophecy is never about determinism, at least in the traditional sense.
Well, in Greek myth, well, go on.
Oh, so I just really appreciated that Denis Villeneuve was so explicit about making that point at the end of Dune Part 1. I'm sorry, go ahead. So in Greek myth...
Well, I was going to say Cassandra in Troy, like... But part of her curse, she's told when... I forget what her crime is. I think not having sex with Zeus or something, as usual. But, like, she... No one... Like, part of the curse is no one's going to believe anything you say. Like, your prophecies will always be right and no one will believe you. Like, she's told that verbatim as opposed to it being just a feature of all prophecy and mythical stories.
Well, and also just to, again, distinguish them, I think... In Greek mythology, there was a very different, like when you have the use of prophecy there, it's very different than the biblical concept of prophecy. They're two very different things. And I think probably in Greek mythology, it's more akin to predicting the future, whereas in Hebrew mythology, the Old Testament, which Christianity ends up absorbing, it's more about displeasing God and having the option to change your ways. Prophecy is about being responsive to doing something wrong, to a warning.
That seems like it's not prophecy then. Like if it's not going to happen, it's just like this will, it's a caution.
Right. And that's because you have a very like contemporary concept of prophecy.
Right.
Again, traditionally that was not what it meant. It was not about determinism and, you know, timelines. It was
like
about
Macbeth. Macbeth is determinism, right?
Exactly, right, exactly, Kelly. And that's a very later Christian, specifically Protestant concept. I think very probably Calvinist.
Which is always frustrating, yeah, because it's like you go, well, they've been right every other time, and like a pillar of fire is telling you something, you're just disregarding it. Like, I don't know. You know what I mean? The Janna stuff went over my head, I admit, even though now it makes me want to watch the first one again.
Well, and again, that might even be me misinterpreting something I saw.
I don't think that was just
my read of it.
Huh. Well, okay. So wait, is that okay? So what's your deal with the ending?
Okay, so then
and you're over under.
Well, I didn't do over unders, Kelly Wand. I'm sorry. Here's how I'm going to weasel out of doing an over under. For me, Dune has been such a singular cinematic experience. I can't equate it. It's not quite like being a child and seeing Star Wars, because I don't have that kind of naivete anymore.
Right,
I went into both Dune movies very guarded. And I fully expected to hate Dune 2, because I did not like the casting of Javier Bardem. I did not want to watch a bunch of wacky Christopher Walken stuff. I did not want to watch a love story between Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya. Like, none of that stuff I wanted. I just wanted awesome action with sandworms and House Atomics and the shield wall collapsing and Shardukar fighting Fadakan, right?
Yeah.
So what won me over were a couple of things. Actually, should I get into this? Like, I'm jumping ahead, but...
No, yeah, go ahead.
So the ending, just because, like, the ending of the first one... I didn't realize the first movie was just a part one when I started watching it.
They always get you, so it's just like Hyperion. You're always of that stick.
Yep, and that's on me, and that's fair enough.
And then you get mad, you turn against it. Oh,
that was a big issue for me. And
I'm not
reading
the second one. Fuck you.
But then I watched the second movie, and he repeats the same issue, is not wrapping it up at the ending, which I find immensely frustrating. I mean, the way this movie ended, to me... Like, I honestly, Kelly Wand, thought you might end the synopsis with Timothée Chalamet flying off into space going, "So long, assholes!"
Yeah.
As he goes out, like, because that's how it felt to me.
Yeah.
Is, you know, all this awesome stuff happened on Dune, and then he just sort of arbitrarily decides, oh, I'm going to go off and have a galactic holy war now.
Yeah.
And you can watch that in the next movie. Stay tuned.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens. You're right. But that's what happens in the books.
It.
So you're chained to... I mean, that to me, like, the thing you hate is the thing that makes these movies interesting is, like, they're based on books written in the 60s by a very conservative man. And so all the plot threads and intricacies are shackled to mainstreaming it with visual spectacle. And so it's just fun to watch that go off the rails in a weird way to me.
I think,
like,
though, I'm just so
Dune
happy.
Messiah is going to be even weirder, so I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah,
it's
I can imagine, but too. I'm just so happy, though, that Denis Villeneuve didn't feel obligated to keep any of Frank Herbert's stuff, though. Like,
no,
I
got the sense he didn't like it.
Yeah, exactly.
He, like, just wanted the visuals. Yeah.
He just wanted the visuals and the spectacle and the lore, the world building. I mean, that stuff is amazing. Yeah.
And I love the visuals. The visual spectacle of this movie.
Oh, of course. That by the way. And I had no reservations about that.
No.
So let me tell you about the things I did have reservations about. First of all, Javier Bardem as Stilgar in the first movie was a big old goofball. I did not need that. I was like, oh my God, I don't want a whole movie of this. So Kelly Wand, in Dune Part 2, when they then established... that there's this bifurcation of the Fremen. They're the Southern fundamentalists with their accents and their wackiness.
Right.
And then they're the more metropolitan Northern ones. I love that.
Yeah.
And so I love that then created a kind of permission structure for Javier Bardem to be a goofball.
Right, and that
worked perfectly for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
So right away... that objection removed. I loved Javier Bardem in this. I loved his tension with the younger generation. I loved all the stuff about the Shia and the Sunni division.
Yeah.
That was great. That was some wonderful world building. Similarly, Kelly Wand, very little Christopher Walken. And they hardly even let him talk.
Yeah.
So Christopher Walken, like,
what
I feel like...
is not in it much.
Well, I feel like His presence is in it, but his dialogue isn't. And that, by golly, that works for me. I have no problem with that. That man's face just has so much meaning and background and baggage and backstory and context for all of us.
He's just fan service. Like, okay, here's the Emperor.
I mean, he's
this one thing.
Yeah. He is imperial. I mean, there was something imperial about Christopher Walken. So that worked for me perfectly.
And Florence Pugh's in it.
So, I didn't mind that. She was great.
Here
was the other thing. Now, I don't know if it's okay to say this. I've been saying it this way, and I mean it in a very respectful way. I don't intend this to sound homophobic. So, Kelly Wand, let me know, is this turn of phrase okay? Is it okay for me to say that, holy cow, I am so gay for Timothée Chalamet?
Like, Yeah.
That's okay to say, right? Like, I don't mean that with any disrespect to anyone.
Why
would it
be
disrespectful?
It's a compliment.
It's a huge compliment.
It just means enthusiastic. Gay
people
should love that.
Yeah. But enthusiastic in a way that surprises me. That to me feels that I just didn't expect. It's something from deep inside me when I see him. I'm just, oh my God, I love this guy.
Yeah.
I want to watch him. I want to listen to him.
You want a little whim in him?
I do. I do, Kelly Wand. Yeah.
I love him too because he looks like how I felt I would have looked. He looks like how I looked when I was younger if I'd been handsome. So
right,
I like
right.
it. I like
he's
skinny,
all of our paws. Exactly.
Heartthrob.
And Kelly Wand, just as an actor, I feel he's really good.
Yeah.
Like, the payoff for this Dune, and this is what surprised me, was not the sandworms converging on the Emperor's ship. That was awesome. I liked it. But Kelly Wand, there was a scene in this movie that was far more thrilling to me. Like, I expected that. The sandworms and the big battle, I expected that was what was going to pull me out of my seat.
Yeah.
But no. Do you know what pulled me out of my seat?
I'm thinking. Timothée Chalamet's Anya Taylor-Joy vision? Because they didn't get...
But, I mean, you're on the right track. I mean...
But did it have something to do with the Ben Jesseret?
No. It was just his speech where he reclaims his identity as an Atreides.
Oh, yeah.
But
that was great.
Asserts that he wants to lead and be part of the Fremen. Like, where he comes out, basically, I guess that was his ascension, you might call it. But that, to me, like, that was the most thrilling part of the movie. Because I realized I cared more about this character than the sandworms or the battle scenes or like that was where the movie just really exploded for me.
Yeah. I'm ambivalent about it because he looks like Paul to me, but in the book, Paul's somewhat calculating and he's been trained in intrigue and combat and he's his father's son and he's his mother's son. And so he comes across as more stoic in the book.
Okay.
And more, like there's less of a transition before and after, but I get why in movies they feel the need to do that.
Well, it's so cinematic. I mean,
I think the only time like where they did something like that, where I was fine with it in the moment, but then later, like when in Lord of the Rings, remember in Return of the King, when Frodo turns on Sam, he's like, you stay here. You stay in Mordor by yourself with no food. I'm going to go on with Gollum into this spider's cave. Fuck you. He's convinced, like, he's good, you're evil. You're the piece of shit, Sam. Like, that doesn't happen in the book. And in the movie, you go, oh, I get it. It's because it's the third movie and we need the conflict, something. But it's like, it's so unrealistic and it's so out of character. And I guess you can go, oh, it's the ring making him do it. But it's just, like, it's such a breach of trust. And it's such, like, we can never look at Frodo the same way again, kind of a thing. Whereas with Paul, I think it's just, I think we attribute it to the water because he's different after he drinks it. And,
also, could it be, Kelly Wand, that you're in better hands with Denis Villeneuve's character development than Peter Jackson's?
Maybe, but I was much, yeah, that's probably true. But I also,
like you were sort of alluding earlier, like I was so dizzy and giddy by from the visuals that I was sort of willing to accept anything.
Sure. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And the and it made more sense to me that he split the thing into two parts, having seen the second part, because the scenes had a lot of room to breathe and the action sequences had a lot of room to just give a sense of space. And there's just like there was a lot more sense like this is a day in the life of the Harkonnens and stuff. And so I liked that. I was really into that. And it made me see, like, why the David Lynch version is kind of unsatisfying and maybe too chintzy, because it's just too quick. And it glosses over a lot of stuff that you can tell. Like, Aaliyah's born and, like, grows up to be, like, 6 or 7 in that movie, like, overnight. And, I don't
know. Wider Life will do that to you, Kelly Warren.
Yeah. It does a lot of things to all the characters. But Duncan Idaho, Jason Momoa's character, he comes back as a Gola in the books.
You know, when you said that, I realized I knew what a Gola was. I don't know how I know that, but
it's Golem and clone equals Gola.
It's the Tali Laxit or whatever they're called. Yeah, I know all that stuff.
Okay.
But I know that from games though, Kelly Wan, not the book.
I love the games, the Dune game. That's the thing. Dune, like I said, I didn't like Dune when I read it as a kid. Like adults would tell me, no, keep going. When you get to the middle half, it's so crazy. But like it didn't have what I was looking for when I was like 9. It was just too political and too slow paced and too text. I don't know. I was really into Foundation, those books. And those seem like, I think, harder even than Dune, maybe, to some people. But, like, they were really easy for me to get into as opposed to Dune. And Dune was sort of hard to grasp. And its strangeness was a big part of it. Like, and it covers thousands of years of history. And there's, like, different factions, and the Fremen are gone, and now these guys are the new Fremen, and the guild's turned into this. And so it's like, if the Godfather was like General Hospital, that's what Dune feels like.
And maybe we'll be talking about that in later movies. Yeah, like I just would be happy for him to scrap anything Herbert did and just tell his own stories at this point.
I'm worried that he will, but
why would you be
Dune worried? Messiah is so weird. Like, I kind of want to see how much he retains of it because it's such a different kind of thing. It's not like an adventure story.
I also had some issues with the Harkonnens. The Harkonnens.
Harkonnens. Yeah,
I'm trying to train myself because I want to accept Denis Villeneuve's pronunciation. So the
Is Harkonnens. He right?
Oh, who knows? But I'll accept it. Okay. I mean, so
Harkonnen.
Kelly Wand, I love Stellan Skarsgård in the first movie. I certainly love David Desmalchian as his Mentat. I'm sorry to see that guy go. Dave Bautista was fine. The Harkonnens didn't work for me as well in the second movie.
It's now, PG-13. That's the
That's
problem.
Part of it. And I did love the visuals, the Getty Prime stuff.
Yeah.
All of that was beyond reproach. Just magical. Amazing. And seeing it in IMAX, by the way.
Yeah.
God damn, I love that.
I know. Your seat's vibrating for 3 hours. It's awesome.
I'm going to give you a butt, though, Kelly Wand. I am so over that played-out trope of brutal leaders casually murdering their underlings.
Yeah, I know. It's like Vader did it, and now everybody does it.
And it doesn't play anymore. Like, no. It's lame.
Well, also, too, you know what's the thing that makes it, and maybe this was the most egregious example of it, because in this, the underlings never saw it coming. Which seems completely implausible. Like, they should be guarding every word that comes out of their mouths.
Right,
like,
right.
Go to bed, beast, rabbit. It's fine. We got this. It's like, they would be lying to him. They would be going, oh, yeah, we found him. We're fine. Everything's good. Yeah, we're on it. Like, they would just be blowing smoke up his ass. They wouldn't.
And that's historically how those things work.
Right. And then that's how empires crumble. Is
right. Yeah, exactly.
The rules.
And also, it didn't help. Like, you've pointed out many times that all of these henchmen were murdered PG-13. So lame.
With the crystal.
Kelly Wand, I cannot stand Austin Butler.
Really? I don't know him. I had never seen him before. I didn't watch the Elvis movie.
I made it partway through the Elvis movie. I dealt with Austin Butler. I mean, you've seen him in Once Upon a Time. You've seen him in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. He's the guy who gets who leads the cultist to Brad Pitt. Like, he's the guy who has the gun. He's got long hair. He's on a horse. He has that line about "I'm the devil's spawn" or whatever. He's the douchebag cultist of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But he's also, I guess you didn't watch that series on Apple about the bombers in World War II, Masters of Air. He was one of the main actors in there.
I watched one out of sequence, and there wasn't a single mission in the show.
Oh, no, you watch episode 5. Masters of Air, fuck that whole series. It's just it's a soap opera. But Masters
watch
of Air,
episode 5,
yeah. It's that one standalone.
That's what my mom said afterwards. I go, there wasn't even any flying in this. And she goes, the one before that's the good one.
Episode 5 is Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, the folks who did Captain Marvel and Half Nelson. But episode 5 of Masters of Air is amazing. And it's that show. Like, if they had just shot that 1 hour, it would have been brilliant.
And Austin Butler's on that show?
He's not in that episode, but he is throughout. I actually read the review in Variety of Masters of Air, called it Austin Butler's Masters of the Air, blah, blah, blah.
Visionary Austin Butler's.
Oh, my God. Anyway, like, here's the thing, though, Kelly Wand. I don't mean to be hard on the guy, because he's, like, a young, attractive actor, and he's fine for certain things. But, no, not this. I did not, like, all he was for this movie was jacked and hairless.
Yes.
That any actor can become jacked and hairless. Like, that is not the prerequisite for Fade Rotha. Like, there needs to be more. There
Sting.
Wasn't more. I mean, why Sting back in the 80s, yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm very salty that who's the guy that played the clown? Why can't I think of his name? The Sarsgaard that played the clown in It.
Oh, Alex?
Bill Skarsgård.
Bill Skarsgård.
Alex is the main, is the one who, Alexander's the one who's overexposed.
Right, okay.
Bill Skarsgård is the one who's super talented from Barbarian, from Atomic Blonde. Why wasn't he Fade Rotha? I am so mad, Kelly Wand.
Maybe he's not jacked enough, and they needed someone.
I guess so. Maybe, okay, you know what, fair point. He might.
I was agnostic him, actually, but I thought the duel was bad for reasons I kind of covered in the opsis. Like, it just
I also,
like,
well, even just
Paul
narratively.
Was outmatched. Huh?
It seemed he was outmatched, but also narratively, why do you come this far and then let it rest on a knife duel? That seems so inane. Just dramatically, it's like, no, that's dumb. That's contrived. That's what you do at the end of a Verdi opera or some bullshit thing like that. That's not what... And I guess maybe that's what they're going for here, this sort of heightened operatic
thing.
Well,
and it's from the book.
It's Conley. I know it's Conley. But it's so... Like, if you're an enlightened society that has space travel, you don't have
lasers.
Conley anymore. That's so dumb.
You have teleportation. Through space.
God, and Conley. Whatever.
Yeah. I know.
But Kelly wants all this. God damn it, I love
and
this
no
movie.
Blood. Yeah.
But still, I love this movie. I love
I
it
do too.
So much. But I just had to... Because I loved it, I have these complaints.
Yeah. But I'm surprised you like the first one more. Because this one... I thought Dune 2 blew Part 1 away for my money.
Well, you know what, Kelly wants? That's
Dune
1's
a bunch of characters being ushered on stage and then off again instantly. That's what
Dune
Part 1 is.
Here's what it is for me. Dune 1, I have seen so many times. It has just meant so... Oh, God, yeah.
It makes me want to watch it again.
I mean, I've seen it. Every time I watch it, I look for something. Here's the thing. Like, the one thing I discovered new the last time I watched Dune Part 1, I'll tell you about right now because I thought it was really cool. Duncan Idaho's ship on, not Caladan, what planet are they from?
Yeah, it's Caladan.
Lands on Caladan, and Timothy Chalamet comes running up, saying, Duncan, you're back, I need to talk to you.
Yeah.
And Duncan is checking his ship, and he's being all Jason Momoa, and he's tossing Timothy Chalamet's hair. Yeah, exactly, I love all that.
Yeah.
Saying things like, hey, you put on muscle. Timothy Chalamet says, really? Duncan Idaho says, no, you have not. Like, I love that.
Aww.
So the reason that Paul wants to talk to him is he's had this dream, this prophecy, in which he saw Duncan Idaho dead. So he wants to warn him and tell him, and he wants to go with him to Arrakis because he's worried about him. And, of course, Duncan's like, no, you're just having dreams. It's very uncertain. But when it shows this dream that Paul had, as he's talking about it, it flashes to the actual dream. And in the dream, you see a dead body, but it's out of focus. You cannot tell for sure that it's Jason Momoa. It has very similar facial hair, and obviously you're looking at Jason Momoa when it cuts, so it's presumably him, but it's out of focus. But it's out of focus enough that there's plausible deniability. So that maybe, yeah, Paul had this dream.
Of a body. Maybe
of a body. But the reason that Jason Momoa's face is out of focus in the dream is because what's in focus is a little beetle crawling on the sand. And that's what the shot is of Paul's dream, is the beetle in the foreground pulling focus, but in the background, presumably Jason Momoa's dead face. So this is the dream that Paul has. Momoa discounts it. The movie carries on.
You and your scarabs.
And then we get to the ecological survey base where Liet Kynes is with Jessica, Jason Momoa, and Paul after the Harkonnens have taken over Arrakis, right? Arrakeen. And Jason Momoa hears a noise and realizes that the Sardaukar have found them and are coming to attack, so he seals himself in a tunnel. Do you remember that scene? And that's where he dies. Before that, while we're talking to Liet Kynes, and Jessica's there, and Paul is there, we see Duncan Idaho sitting in the sand playing with the beetle.
Oh, that's awesome.
So the callback to that beetle, I mean, and I just love, I never noticed that before, but I just love the callback to that beetle. And yeah, exactly. Like, Denis Villeneuve is such a dense, rich, careful storyteller. And so that also gets Kelly Wand
lyrical.
At this whole idea of prophecy being not about determinism, but on the contrary, prophecy is about agency.
Huh.
It's about seeing a possible outcome and having the capacity to change it, to affect it. That's just why I really respond to what he's doing in Dune 1 and that reveal at the end of Dune 1 where Paul kills Janice and has basically ruined his prophecies.
Right. Right.
Oh, so
that
anyway, my point...
prophecy.
And my point was going to be, I've just seen Dune 1 so many times.
Did you feel like Paul now?
Well, it's just something I really enjoy doing with 2.5 hours. It's just letting Dune play and paying attention to it. And I don't necessarily identify with any characters. Like, I love what he's done for Lady Jessica, making her a main character.
Yep.
And that's another thing that I'm a little irked about in the second
movie. It's not in the second book.
Well, I feel like in the second movie, they just kind of send her south and forget about her.
That's what happens in the book, though.
I'm not happy with that. Kelly Wand, I want closure.
I think I kind of want to see both the movies like together as like a full unbroken marathon, and then maybe it'll feel differently. I mean, she's in it. I mean, I kind of like what they did with Jessica. I mean...
Oh, I love what they did. The character was awesome.
She was really convincing.
Yeah, I just wanted to know more about where she was going, what she was doing, what was going to happen with her.
She gets what she wants. She lives happily ever after.
Tell you what, I didn't expect a cliffhanger. That's my main issue with the ending.
Is it supposed to be a cliffhanger? Or is it just an ambivalent
We don't
ending?
Know what happened. All of the characters are left at a very fraught minor note in terms of what's going on in their lives,
But isn't the implication that Paul's beaten his enemies? Like, isn't that a strong sense?
No, because he has to go fight all the houses now.
That we've never seen before.
He wanted
to know nothing of what just happened.
He wanted to reclaim himself as the head of House Atreides.
Right.
And now, even that is not recognized by the rest of the galaxy.
Oh.
Like, nobody is recognizing this position that he's taken. As controlling the spice, as being the head of Atreides, None. Everything he did didn't work.
How many houses are there besides
14.
Shadow? There's 14 houses.
I just made that up. I have no idea.
Interesting.
Shout out Mapes. I don't think is a house.
She deserves one. I think she's dead.
Probably. Yeah.
Ugh.
Well, Kelly Wand, we did a Dune podcast.
Yeah.
You should go get your front door.
All right.
And we thank everyone for listening. We may be back in the future. Thanks for bearing with us as our schedules allow.
Yeah, and, sorry about that. It's mostly my fault this time.
So. And yeah, Dune 2, we did it, Kelly Wand.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening. I am Tom Chick. I've been here with Kelly Wand.
Tom, do Mentats take Mentats?
What makes them crazy? I don't know. Never seen anything like it before. There must be something in the water. What makes them crazy? I don't know. Never seen anything like it before. There must be something in the water. Yep, there must be something in the water.
Hey, Tom, in the book parody, it was called the Abdul Jabbar.
I prefer that we be more capable and prepared than lucky. Observation, reflection, faith, and determination. In this way, we may navigate the path as it unfolds before us. All right, and we have, what, 8 more recharge cycles to go before we get to Uruguay 6?
Is that a question,
yes,
sir?
Yes, Walter, that's a question.
That is correct.
I just realized there are Mentos. Did you mean to say Mentats? Mentos or Mentats?
I thought they were Mentats. Peter DeVries the Mentat.
Right. But Mento is the candy.
No, Mentats from Fallout.
Oh my god, I thought you were doing a Mento. And it's actually Mentos. I totally... Kelly Wand, I'm not enough of a nerd to have gotten that one. Very good.
You never get Fallout references. They just irritate you. Can't wait for the show, right?